Welcome back to the Alan and Warren Report. In this case, the Euro and Warren Report. I am joined today by a very special guest from across the pond, as it were. Euro, former host of the Absolute State of Britain podcast, which was on the Right Stuff Network for quite a while there, and who I met. He is one of the personalities involved in Patriotic Alternative over there. I met him while I was attending the conference on that fateful day of October 7th. And later we got the chance to hang out quite a bit during my week over there and became friends. So and I told him at the time I wanted to have him on a show, and this is the perfect opportunity to do it. We have some stuff in the news with UK, so Euro, welcome to the show.
Sven needs me to sign up for a paywall subscription at therightstuff.biz/paywall. Okay, Sven, I'm your number one guy. I'll do it.
Hello, Warren, and thanks for having me on. It's always good to come on a show like this, and I'm a keen listener. I listen to you and your dad every week, so it's fun to be on.
Oh no, it's great to have you on, and I'm sure TASOB, dedicated TASOB listeners will be glad to hear your voice again. I was not a regular listener of the show. In fact, the only episodes I heard were the ones I was actually on, but you had me on, I think, maybe two shows. I think it was more than one. And, or maybe it was more than two. I don't know. It was two or three shows, and I had a great time. Every time it was a fantastic discussion. And, but I have to say, I told you this when I met you, that all the hosts kind of, when you have like three hosts or more to a show, I feel like it becomes, it's not like Strike and Mike where there's two personalities, two dynamic personalities, and you know the one and then you know the other one. It's like yin and yang. But when you have three hosts, they tend to blend together. So the TASOB hosts, you were just one of several to me. And I was like struggling to remember, I guess, the Ayatollah, cause he does his own show now. The Friday night dinner or whatever, which I was on, recently, and had a blast with him and met him also in the, at the PA conference. Wonderful guy. But the three of you, the regular hosts there, it was sort of a jumble, and I didn't really distinguish. And that's probably true of anybody who was a casual listener, anyone who wasn't a dedicated listener, where you kind of suss out, you get to know the different voices and the different personalities and the names behind them. But you were, I guess, were you the longest running TASOB host for altogether?
Yeah. So, originally it was a guy called Ash, and then there was, me. So, I go by Euro, but my screen name then was Europeon. So like an insignificant European person, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, then we had Nativist Concern, who just became Native. And that was the original lineup for all of about 12 shows. And that's when I took over kind of leading the thing. And I was on right till the very end, essentially. And then we had, so it was the Ayatollah joined us for episode 13. And then he was on for quite a while. And we had a couple of lineup changes. So we had Ruffy and Dick, and we had Charlie Big Potatoes, and a couple of others who were on for, you know, not as many episodes, but, it was a good run.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how long did it run from? From when to when?
You know, just off the top of my head, it was, I want to say, it was like just over 2 years. I think it was 130 episodes. So like one a week, 52 a year. Yeah. So, a bit over 2 years. And, it was a couple of years back now that we stopped. One of the things when we did stop, it was, we had a change in the lineup, and then I didn't think that there was a problem with that dynamic of three people. I think it worked quite well. Although, you know, we certainly developed a bit of the, TDS kind of thing where we were all trying to talk over one another. And in the beginning, we were a bit more structured, but by the end, it was just, you know, kind of everybody talk over each other and try and get their points in. So I do see that. I did always find it odd though, how people couldn't tell us apart, like people who were regular listeners. I mean, I sort of understand near native, both being southerners from in or around London. But the Ayatollah sounds nothing like us. And people couldn't even get those, you know, couldn't even distinguish us from him, which I found kind of funny.
When you say people, do you mean American listeners or?
Yeah, I think American listeners, they're just like, an Englishman just sounds the same.
Yes.
Regardless. Yes. You know, there's quite a lot of accents over here. Some of them are quite funny. Yes.
Oh, yes, yes. So just to be fair to the audience, Euro and I actually, it just worked out where I was going and where he was going. And we got to, after the PA conference, we got to spend quite a bit of time together. I was only there for a week and we had, three separate days, I guess, two evenings where we got a chance to just talk and enjoy a good meal and share a pint. And it was fantastic. And we had some wonderful conversations about England and about the UK generally and got to travel around a little bit. So I knew when I was going over there, it's funny, I didn't have a structure to my week. I set aside a week and it really sucks. I got sick. I can't believe you didn't get sick, by the way, because we were hanging out when I was like really coming down. I didn't want to disappoint this guy and tell him, man, I feel like crap. But I did warn him. I was like, well, listen, I don't want to get you sick. And he was like, that's okay. I'm not worried about it. And, we sat and had a whole meal together and, I was feeling pretty shitty, but I had some beer and that made me feel better temporarily once a in the moment, you know, I felt good.
Well, I mean, I'm not immunocompromised. I haven't had any of these dodgy injections. So, I had nothing to fear. And I think that I probably had whatever you were coming down with. I think that I'd got the same illness like a couple of weeks before. So it had already burned through and I was immune.
That's what I think. I think it was some kind of island illness, because what's really funny is then the next day, the day that I recorded with Mark, the day before that, I spent the whole day in bed, which really sucked because I got this 1 week in the UK and I end up spending, but it was a very nice place where I was staying. And it was once I accepted that I couldn't be out and about, that I just was going to lose a day. Once I accepted it and made peace with it, then I was okay. Then I was like, wow, I'm in England. It's really cozy. The food here is amazing. Like I'm in this very old little, what do you call it? Not a hotel, but it was like I guess it would have been a hotel a long time ago, but very small. It's like a big house. It's like a large house. I was staying in this room. It was very nice and very cozy. And if you're going to be sick, that's a nice place to be sick. So once I accepted that, it was fine. But then I took a whole day to recover and then I went to do the show with Mark live, and that whole show, I feel, just a little bit upset because my one time there to do a live show with Mark, I am obviously feeling like crap. My parents even were like, wow, you look really tired in that video. And I'm like coughing the whole time, but Mark didn't get sick either. So, I think it must have been some sort of English, disease that had burned through all you guys. And then it hit me like I was the old Native Americans, you know, when they first came into contact with the European illnesses. But I got over it fairly fast. So I'm glad you didn't get sick, but we had a great time. And a lot of our conversations that we had, I'm going to get into some of that stuff again with you now that we have a chance to talk, because
absolutely. I mean, it was great to meet you in person. And of course, you know, like you can become much better friends when you finally get to meet someone in person. But we did have you on a couple of times on the show, and I distinctly remember we had you on kind of, I think it was, you weren't not known under your, I think it was just after the foundation of the NJP, perhaps.
I remember that.
Kind of put your name to the founding of the NJP, but people didn't know really who is Warren Baylog. So it was I had you in the title as Warren/Ahab.
And I remember
you also,
that.
You know, I would have mentioned your wife, but that was again something I wasn't sure if you were kind of making that known at the time. You wanted to keep that a bit quiet. So
I remember. Yeah, now I do. Because I had just come out under. It's like, okay, now you can. Everybody can stop calling me Ahab, and you can start calling me Warren. And that was a big step. And I remember I had scheduled that show with you guys. I think we had scheduled that, and then it just worked out that that it was right when I had started when I dropped Ahab. I think that first
one might have been called "What Would Hitler Do," but I might be mistaken.
It may have been. Yeah, they were great shows. No, they were fantastic shows, and it was really, really enjoyable. But yes, for Americans, this is what I was going to say. I booked a whole week over there, and I didn't know where exactly I was going to be. I thought I knew I had the conference, but then I thought I'll leave it up to. I had a few things I wanted to see, but I thought, you know, who I end up hanging out with, it'll depend on who I meet at the conference and everything. So it was a totally unexpected thing, meeting you and befriending you. It was just, it was not something I planned on, and it was very pleasant. But yes, all British people to Americans, it's not that you all sound alike, but it's just if you get three British guys, three English guys on a podcast, no one's going to know who's who, based on the accent anyway, unless it's very distinctive, like one personality is incredibly distinctive. But it is funny, and this is something we're going to talk about, is the regions of England. So I'm going to get into this. We'll probably do that more in the second hour, because the first hour here is free, and then the second hour will be behind the TRS paywall. So in the second half, I'll probably get more into the real deep English stuff, and we'll cover more like the news and things in this first hour. But yeah, it seems like when you're in England, every town has a different accent. And not only that, but every person who's over there can tell the difference. You know, my mother, she has there's a herd of deer. So we have, that was the other thing, a funny thing with the deer. You guys don't have deer over there, just like wild. We have deer everywhere here, especially in the, you know, rural place like West Virginia. And we have a different species of deer too, which this is another thing I'm going to get into, is the little differences with UK and US, because I haven't really had a chance to talk about this since I got back. But the white-tailed deer, the North American deer, you guys don't have over there, but they're everywhere here. And my mom, she always has, is very kind to the deer, and she feeds them. And there's a family of deer that's been coming to my parents' home for many, many, many years. And she is able to tell, she has names for all of them, and she's able to tell by their faces which is which. And she has names for all of them. And I'll come over, you know, I used to, when I was living there, I would know the one from the other. But then now, you know, if I come and I visit, I come over and there's a herd of deer in the front yard. And she throws some bread out to them or some corn. And she's like, well, you recognize which one that one is, right? And I'm like, no, I can't tell the difference. And she's like, how can you not tell the difference? I'm like, because I don't see them every day. But she's able to, just by their faces, because they have deer actually have incredibly distinct faces. But it's something that if you are not looking at them every day, you're not going to notice. And I think that's the way it is.
It's probably like when you meet a couple of people who are twins.
Right.
You can't tell them apart, but once you get to know them, you start to notice, oh, that's that one. And, you know,
yes,
that's the one.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is fascinating to me. And I also, to just tease what we will talk about, people know that when I gave my speech in Florida, the beginning of this year, I had just read American Nations, which goes over all the origins of the United States. And it was based on a book called Albion Seed, which the subheading is Four British Folkways in America by David Hackett Fisher. And, it really, is the first time that I've ever become incredibly aware of the different regions of England proper and the different sort of everything. I mean, how diverse England is, not the UK, not the British Isles, but England, just the country England, how different the regions are and the different histories and all that. And it's something that I think as Americans, like we were talking before we started recording, you guys, I'm sure, are aware of the different regions of the United States, the North, the South, the Deep South, Florida, the Hollywood, you know, Southern California, the Pacific Northwest, the Appalachian Mountains, New England, the Midwest, the Plains, the Rocky Mountains. I think you guys would probably be more aware of those regions, but I think as Americans, I mean, I'm a historically minded person and I know a lot about Europe, but I was completely ignorant about the different regions of England and the different cultural differences and histories prior to coming over there. So if I was that ignorant of it, I'm sure a lot of people in our audience are also incredibly ignorant about it. So I think it'll be fun to get into that because you're a guy, you're well traveled and you know a lot of the history.
Hey, you're still listening to only half the show? Get behind the paywall and get the rest of the story. Go to therightstuff.biz/paywall and choose the subscription model that works best for you. And don't forget, every Tuesday evening, there is an Odyssey stream where Sudden Sun will take your donations through a credit card or a debit card in exchange for a subscription. You have no idea how much content you're missing. Go to therightstuff.biz/paywall and let's fix that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be glad to talk about all that and whatever else. So what would you like to kind of kick it off with? What do you want to talk about first, really?
Well, we'll kick it off. Let's kick it off just with I want to briefly just mention the whole stuff in the news right now. We spoke a little bit before we started recording that all this stuff with Tommy Robinson, you're, of course, still a dedicated TDS listener, and you said they covered it pretty well. But I wanted to get your thoughts on it because you were the TASAB host and all this. This whole war in Gaza, which started, I keep calling it this war in Gaza. It's not really a war. It's just a massacre. I mean, it's just a genocide. But this whole thing kicked off the day of our conference. And now it's been a little more than a month and close to 10 days, and 1 month and 9 days when we're recording this. We're recording this on Thursday, actually, because I'm going to be traveling again this weekend. It seems like we're dealing with the same old problem where this issue is being turned, the whole Tommy Robinson thing and the thing we had happen last weekend, the march, the cenotaph and Armistice Day and all that, and the pro-Palestinian rally. It seems that there are very, very dedicated, interested parties in channeling both sides, really, into ends that are not helpful for either the people of Gaza or the white people of Britain, right?
Yeah, so I think Tommy was banned off Twitter, as are many actual nationalists and dissidents, and he got his Twitter back like a week before this was all going to happen, and he's kind of been put to bed and put out to pasture because what he was doing really died a death and it was getting less and less effective. And one of the things that really put a nail in the coffin was this BLM stuff. And when BLM were going out and trying to attack statues in London, and of course the kind of people who support Tommy, they're of a fairly simple-minded view of the issues. You know, their hearts are often in the right place, and they have varying degrees of alcoholism problems, but you know, their hearts in the right place, and so they have an instinctual response on these issues. So the sorts of people who have the instinctual response of, well, we don't want lots of Muslims in our countries causing problems and getting away with heinous crimes because the police aren't punishing them for the crimes they do commit, you know, those same people are going to say, well, we don't like criminal blacks engaging in vandalism, desecrating statues honoring the heroes of our past and kind of shitting all over our culture, you know, racial strangers kind of telling us that they hate our history and our people and everything that our nation has stood for. So I think originally Tommy was going to go to that, and he kind of called it off at the last minute. But a lot of these not as well informed nationalists would go to something like that. And of course it was a setup from the beginning, where, you know, the usual thing happens. The white people get attacked, They defend themselves, they get jailed for defending themselves, and then it's all over the news how the far right started the fight. So that was a big discrediting thing for Tommy, definitely. Because he makes the issue solely about Islam. He won't talk about race. Or if he does, it's always in a positive sense. And recently he was talking about, you know, oh, we love the Sikhs and the Hindus. It's just, you know, just Islam that we don't like because they're mean to the gays or what have you.
Let me pause you for 1 second there. Let's backtrack. Let's say because this whole show, Euro, what I want to do is I want to give it like for a dumb American who doesn't know anything, who doesn't follow what's going on in the UK at all. I want to start from the beginning. So, who is Tommy Robinson? I mean, you don't have to give me his whole like Wikipedia background, but who, what I mean is, when did this guy first gain, like my dad, for instance, if he listens to this, he's not going to know who this guy is. When did he first gain prominence and how is he known by the, and again, like you said, you're a younger guy. You're not way back with the BNP and all this, like some of the guys like Mark and others. So you don't know some of the history going way back as well as Mark.
I wasn't really radicalized until the whole kind of Trump energy thing kicking off
right.
around 2016.
With that as a caveat, you know, you're an intelligent person who follows the news. So certainly you would have heard of the EDL or you would have seen this guy, who he is, in the news. So you can just tell me what your perceptions were, but who is this guy and how did he get famous and why do people care what he thinks about anything?
Well, Tommy Robinson was one of the founders of the English Defence League. He's kind of like the guy who founded the English Defence League, although there were a lot of others involved at various levels. But I think if I'm not mistaken, it was originally, you know, defending a monument or it was either some kind of monument or, Remembrance Day, one of these cenotaphs, war memorials. And, I think there were soldiers or families of soldiers. And this was related to the Iraq war, where we went and invaded Iraq for Israel of no benefit, to the British people. And then Muslims who were in the UK obviously were offended by, that whole thing, and they were spitting on British soldiers or the families of British soldiers. And that was the first thing that caused Tommy, who's, I think he was a bit of a football hooligan before, which just means he's somebody who, you know, likes watching football and getting into fights, essentially. That's the thing too,
the football hooligan.
Yeah.
It's a
big waste of energy. I mean, it is very much bread and circuses, and it's interesting looking back at historical stuff. And they had, you know, like the chariot racing in ancient Rome. They had Team Red versus Team Blue getting into fights like they do with modern day football, which, you know, you guys call soccer. But essentially he was one of these guys. He liked a bit of a fight, broadly patriotic, didn't like racial strangers of foreign religion, you know.
Oh shit, he's my age. He was born in, well, he's a little younger than me, a few months. He's 27th of November, 1982.
Yeah. So this, just quick overview then. He started this group and it was in response to, you know, hostility from Muslims in Britain, against white people, the government, soldiers, and the Iraq war generally. And as time went on, this became a broader kind of street movement. And it was largely fueled as well by, I mean, there was a period of time where we had more terrorism. So obviously you had, September 11th when a government which was not Iraq or anyone else of that same background attacked the US, in the way that they did. And that was the springboard for the US to invade various countries in the Middle East.
Sure.
Britain, being America's bitch, essentially just joined in and, went to the same wars. So there was a period of, we've been for a couple of waves, essentially. There was a period of increased terrorism, which was largely a response to these wars indirectly.
Right.
And the government had a very strange way of allowing these Muslim preachers to so-called radicalize people over here. And so, you know, certain people have said that that's because they can then turn around and use them in the other gay ops they do. So when they spin up something like ISIS, there's a ready pool of recruits here to go over there and fight other wars for Israel. But we had a period of terrorism. And of course, our big terrorist attack was on the 7th of July. And they chose that date specifically because it wouldn't confuse the Americans, because it's 7/7 either way, unlike 11/9 when they attacked America, supposedly. And so this was something that was going on. So people in the UK were getting very frustrated by attacks from racial strangers of foreign religion that the government wasn't doing enough about. The government was at least indirectly causing via their wars in the Middle East and not doing enough to prevent. And also there was an undercurrent of people who knew about the mass rape of children going on at the hands of Islamic, mainly Pakistani gangs, mainly in the north of England. And that's something it's come out more recently. But the numbers of people they prosecute for it they're just a drop in the ocean compared to what actually has been going on. And it's still covered up to a great extent. And the stuff that you do see of people being prosecuted, it's kind of like, well, look, we put these 10 people in jail 15 years after they raped this one girl. So forget about the other 100,000 or whatever who've been abused by these people. So, and of course there was a Labour MP, and Labour, of course, is the party that was, that's largely supported by Muslims in the UK. Even came out and talked about this within the last, I wouldn't say 5 years, Sarah Champion, and she lost her job within the party because she dared to talk about the mass rape of children. So that was something that was led to the increasing of the EDL, and possibly some of the few prosecutions that we do see are at least in part spurred by the government being fearful of the power of this group. But as much as they, you know, they were motivated by real issues and issues that wouldn't necessarily come to larger public attention for a while in outside of these concentrated areas where people would be more directly aware. They had this culture of drunkenness and, you know, like, well, the Muslims don't like alcohol and pork, so we're going to get drunk because, you know, part of our Britishness is drinking alcohol. So we'll go to a demonstration and we'll get drunk. And then, of course, that leads to people getting into trouble and generally making a fool of themselves. And there's a comedian on British TV who I despise, whose name is Russell Howard. And he mocked, there was a video of one guy who was attending an EDL demonstration. And they asked him, like, why are you here? What are you protesting against? And, you know, he wanted to say, well, I'm here to protest against Islamic rape gangs. But because he was so drunk, he said, Muslimic rape gangs. And they said, oh, look, Muslimic ray guns. Isn't it so funny? These people are all thickos. You know, there's no, they're just making this all up about children being raped. They're just a bunch of drunk idiots who want to fight.
Oh, man. Well, so was the EDL, because again, this is stuff you and I talked about. The EDL, I'm looking, it was founded in 2009, but the chief thing I remember about the EDL is of like, they had that kind of, the masked up street thug look, and they were burning, they were burning swastika flags. I remember that about the EDL, and it seemed incredibly like astroturfed. But I guess this guy has been complaining even in the beginning. Again, I'm just looking at his Wikipedia.
Right from the very start, this was deeply intertwined with the so-called counter-jihad movement, which the counter-jihad thing was an astroturfed movement to kind of see Islam as Islam generally as the enemy, to not see the problem with the mass importation of a foreign race of people who don't share our values, but Islam specifically. So it'd be all right if all these people came over and they weren't Islamic.
Right.
The counter-jihad worldview. And of course, that was something, it was spread by Zionists. It's something that they can use to kind of justify their wars. And they can say, well, you know, look, you know, these people, they're savages because they're Muslim. And so, you know, you should support Israel and you should support wars where we go over there and kill millions of them. And it's a very low information.
Hey, what's up? You know, you're only hearing half of the show, right? And it's being indiscriminately interrupted with these sales pitches because we just don't know how else to get your attention and get you over there. Our website, our podcasts are 100% listener funded. They are funded with your subscription. So if you could please do that, help us out. therightstuff.biz/paywall. Thanks.
Grug position. And as time's gone on, more and more people have realized how that's not the case, and there are factors, you know, guiding these things more than just Islam itself. And so it's, you know, there was a couple of things that led to the death of the EDL. So Tommy decided essentially to shut the organization down because I think he realized it was getting to a point where he might be usurped by more clear-minded nationalists who understood the problems, and he wanted to kind of destroy it before it could be turned in that direction, because it was always meant to be this gay op to you know, do the judo move and take a natural aversion to racial strangers and turn it into wars for Israel whilst avoiding you know, kind of the issues of mass immigration and how they've got here in the first place.
Great replacement. I mean, let's call it, yeah, what it is. I mean,
the great replacement is a term, coined by Guillaume Fay, if I'm not mistaken, the Frenchman.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm happy to just say white genocide.
Yeah.
It is a plan for, the mass replacement of white people, and the genocide in that sense, even if not, directly killing. You know, it meets at least two of the UN's own definitions on what constitutes genocide. It's a deliberate act.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, because I mean, the counter jihad thing, like, I never really studied, because anything that was pro-Zionism, I always immediately wrote it off as just, you know, bought and paid for by Jew money. But, I remember, because I was involved. I mean, I was following things certainly prior to 9/11, and I remember that type of thing didn't exist at all. I mean, there was the BNP, and there was the concerns with migrants and all that. That was certainly big. I remember in 1999, 2000, when I was aware of that and was following the BNP, but I don't remember any kind of the threat is Islam. You know, is the religion of Islam and people who practice Islam is the threat, not anything racial.
Well, this is one of the big differences between the US and the UK or in Europe in general, is that the kind of migrants that you get, they are more so from South America and places like that, whereas we do get Arabs and other Muslims from different parts of the world in Europe for various reasons, and even to the extent, like, if you as an American meet a Pakistani in America, they're more likely to be the upper class, well-educated type.
Yes.
Whereas over here, we have a concentration of Pakistani Muslims, not just from a particular region, but like a sub-region within Kashmir, I think, near the India-Pakistan border disputed territory. We have a population of Pakistanis from that region in particular, who have massive rates of inbreeding, and marriage to their first cousin is a common occurrence. So massive rates of inbreeding and particularly strong Islamic views, and they have come to the UK and settled mainly in the north, in the previously industrial north of the country,
right,
but also in areas in and around London. So yeah, just broadly, you know, our north is akin to your south.
Right.
London has always been kind of the mercantile heart, the money and finance. But the north is actually, unlike the American south, the north had a lot of industry. There was heavy industry. There was steel mills, you know, there was Sheffield Steel, and right, there were car plants and things like that. And it's these areas that were decimated by deindustrialization and the closing of the coal mines that have been hardest hit by the mass immigration of these Pakistani communities. And wherever there are huge numbers of Islamics in Europe, and especially Pakistanis and from this particular region, you do see these cases of familial rape gangs where people, even within their own family, I mean, you're always going to have bad people within any race, but I don't know of any instance where a white person is going out and raping people, let alone children, with their own brother or uncle.
Oh, yeah.
But that is something that you see in the Islamic community.
Well, I've joked many times on this network about my old Pakistani friend from college who I met at an anti-Israel demonstration. And he's someone that, came to this country. He's been in this country, from the age of 13 and, from a prosperous like family, all in the medical field, which is typical of that type of thing here. And, this guy's a real black sheep, has always been very political and very, and we, you know, we used to argue. I've known him now 20 years, and we always used to argue about different things, about, you know, a race-based ideology versus, you know, he was never a very like practicing Muslim. But you know, I think through contact with me, he got actually a little bit more into his roots, into his heritage, and, got a little bit more into the Islamic thing. But we used to talk about this a lot, and he said he was a big gamer. Still is, actually. And he said that, you know, he would talk to these guys in England, and they're the Pakistanis, like the British Pakistanis, were like the dumbest, crudest guys, like the worst American blacks, you know.
They the rates of inbreeding are just off the charts. And then,
I don't think that
Islam is solely the problem, but I do believe that if you follow a religion that says that it's okay to rape and enslave foreigners, that you are more likely to do that. And if you have that in your culture, for generations, then it's going to come through regardless, even if those people were more secular. But I don't believe there's any such thing as a Pakistani middle class. You know, I think it's either like the elite or the lower class, which is what we get over here. And I don't think there's very much in between.
Yeah, well, this guy grew up in a very nice place in a gated like community kind of thing, but he told me stories about when he was growing up. I mean, there was like feral dogs in the streets, and I mean, it's still like the third world, even though where he grew up, how he grew up. I mean, the family had servants and things. I mean, it was much more, much nicer, much higher standard of living, ironically, than he had when he came to the United States. But you know, right next door is a lot of poverty. But, you know, the interesting thing to me also, and this is just a little aside. I mean, there's so many things I want to hit with you in this conversation, but we're inevitably going to miss a few things and we're going to weave in and out. But one thing I want to quickly weave into when we can get back on the main line here with the EDL is just the reality that, groups which even might naturally enjoy a lot of things in common, fellowship, it's possible to create problems between groups, between individuals. I mean, let's put it this way. Let me put it another way. Let's say you have two neighbors, and they are both nice people, and they get along, and they have families, and their families get along, and they help each other out, and they're good neighbors, right? Well, let's say that you took the one guy and moved him into the bedroom of the other guy. So in other words, the other guy has his house and his kitchen and his dining room and his living room, and then he has his bedroom with his wife, and he has a big queen or king size bed in his bedroom, and that's where he goes to bed every night with his wife. Now, let's say the husband from the other house, or the husband and wife, you move them in to that bedroom also. So now you have to put a new bed in the bedroom, or you have to throw a sleeping bag on the floor or a cot or something, or they're going to try to sleep in the same bed because there's no place to sleep. What's going to happen is people who naturally would have gotten along just fine and had no issue, now they have an actual material point of conflict. You see what I mean? There's an actual, you know, dispute here now that's going to happen because
I do, but I think this is one of those things where because of the difference in the people that you get, I don't think Americans necessarily understand the kind of feelings that you get towards the Pakistani community and the Muslim community generally in the UK and in Europe. They're not completely invented by the Zionists. I think there is a natural conflict there that's purely just more than proximity.
Well, here's why I'm saying that. Let me finish. Because we do understand based on the way American blacks are. Okay. The blacks in America are just unpleasant people to be around. They are rude, obnoxious, violent, dangerous, loud. They just destroy any area where they go to. And they drive people out. And they bring a lot of problems, and they've got a lot of problems, and they're inherent to them. Now maybe they're not, maybe they could be improved somehow. Or maybe it's something that they've been made worse by American culture and American society. But the reason I stress this is because, yes, I'm sure, and from everything I've seen, the Pakistanis in Britain and especially in Northern England are a particularly bad type. They're a particularly bad seeds. And there's things about them that are particularly awful that no one would want to be around. But I have to say that my point is that, because the danger with somebody like Tommy Robinson, I heard his quote where he was saying, oh, these Sikhs I get along with great though. You know, that's the danger is that there are people who are way, like with American blacks. I mean, I will say this, Euro, in the United States, the racial issues are a lot more complicated these days than they were like when my dad was my age. Because it used to be in America, there was one racial problem. It was blacks. And it was blacks versus whites was the source of the problem. In the South, in the North, in the cities, wherever. Blacks versus whites, blacks being a problem, racial tensions between blacks and whites. And in the last 20, 25 years, we have had such an influx of literally people from all over the world. Asians, East Asians, South Asians, Middle Easterners, Africans from different parts of Africa, because Africa's huge, South Americans, Central Americans, literally every part of the world, except Europe. but we've had massive amounts of these people, and a lot of them, most of them actually, if you compare them to American blacks, are not as bad. It's easier to live around them. Even
the,
like,
the oft-quoted refrain that these immigrants have lower crime rates than Native Americans.
Yes, yes, exactly. So and I'm not just talking about like your educated Indian or Pakistani or Arab or whatever, or even African. I mean, I've met very educated African doctors and everything who are like coal black, but they're that talented 1%, you know, or they're good at what they do. But even like your Guatemalans, I mean, your really low IQ, like, small cranium, people who are like Central Americans who are very primitive, people. But they do like lawn care or something, and they all live in the same, 10 of them live in a room or something like that. They're kind of unpleasant to be around, but they're still not as bad as your American blacks, who are really violent and dangerous and a problem, you know? So it's,
yeah, there is a difference, obviously. You know, the issue over here is that, you know, communities, like especially the Pakistani and Muslim communities, they're a lot more cohesive and they're a lot more
right,
kind of prone to group action. And so they do things that are more insidious in terms of taking over, particular areas and, turning them into Islamic Pakistani enclaves. But we do have.
Hey, are you still listening? You should get behind the paywall. Go to therightstuff.biz/paywall and get yourself a subscription.
Whereas in the UK, the Muslims are mainly, formerly industrial north, and in and around London, and not so much in the, more rural areas, although that is of course changing. We do have blacks in the UK, and they are largely concentrated, in London, essentially. And I actually remember seeing a little graphic a while back, and it shows, the map with the area of London. It says there's more blacks living here in the area of London than there is here. And it shows the entirety of the continent of Africa, save for the country of South Africa. There's more blacks in London than there are whites in the entire continent of Africa, save for South Africa. But so we do have quite a concentration of blacks. And I actually went to a largely African school when I was growing up. My primary school, which I guess is what you guys would call elementary school, they had a steel drum band. You know, that's a particularly Caribbean thing. And then I went to a secondary school, what you call high school, that was also largely black. And they're not quite as bad as they are in America, because I think a lot of the blacks that we have over here, they are not descendants of slaves. They are more recent immigrants, and though they are more prone to crime and antisocial behavior more generally, they just don't have that same history or access to firearms. Although right, there are still, right, you know, firearms, illegal firearms over here, you're much more likely to be stabbed over here. But they're not quite as bad, but they are kind of stewing in that American black culture, which leads them to act in more and more criminal ways. And I will say that I personally, within the last five years, and maybe it was a little bit before that, but within the last decade, certainly, me and a friend, we were attacked by Africans, and there wasn't really any particular reason. It was, it started with a shove. We were attacked, and it was a rare occasion. The police actually came and there were four assailants, and the police only arrested one, and only because he directly threatened the police. They let the other three go, and they just were not interested. They yes. were not interested in the slightest in yeah. pressing charges, even against the one African gentleman who had assaulted or who had threatened to assault the police directly. And the refrain was, well, they called us N-word. And so, they started the fight. And the police were not interested. They did not want it to be recorded. I remember telling them I wanted this recorded as a hate crime because I thought it was racially motivated. And I'm pretty sure they did not do that, but they should have done by their own laws.
Yeah.
So they are not seeking to enforce the law in any way.
This is my point with the whole bedroom analogy is that. What's astounding, and this is sort of the whole thing also with my speech when I was over there, the astounding thing for Americans is the idea that you have these people being deposited in a place like England. I mean, you and I, while we were over there, we didn't get much time together, but we did see a couple of places. We saw the ruins of an old Tudor house from the Tudor era. Which is something I've only ever read about, my whole life. I've read about it. I mean, this is what I covered in my speech. My whole life I've read these things about England, and there I was. I didn't get to see much of it, but I saw a sample. There I am in a house actually built of the Tudor era with Tudor family, dramas and intrigues around it. And then we saw another, castle that was built in the high medieval era of Edward the First. It's like for this ancient homeland of white people, of white civilization and the long culture and everything of the England, the history of England the way we romanticize it in the US that I talked about in my speech, to have these people deposited in large groups in these places is just absolute insanity. It's absolute madness. I mean, it's madness on a level that's, like civilizational. It's like a civilization gone insane. This country, it makes sense that this was to some extent, it was a wild country. It was not explored. The people that were living here were essentially a Stone Age population, very thinly spread, who happened to come over. I mean, they didn't have any real, in South and Central America, they had more actual civilization, but there were, certainly in North America, there were no large cities or giant buildings, temples, especially in where I live in West Virginia and in the mountains and most of what is the United States. And, all the people here came here fairly recently with the white people, all the oldest white people that are here 500 years. And wave after wave of different white people from different areas. And then we've had all these other influxes of people. So, you can kind of make the idea that this is not so much that it's a nation of immigrants, but that it's still, contested as to who is going to dominate this space historically, on a millennial, timeline, on a thousand
year. You can sort of make that argument, but at the end of the day, it comes down to consistency. Because the same people who take the position that, America is not a land for the white men who settled it and built the land into what it is today, they don't want to give the country back to the Native Americans.
No, they don't.
So if you are being consistent in that point, that should be what you want to happen. So, if it's not going back to the Native Americans, then perhaps it should stay with the whites. But, in the UK, we are third class, not even second, but third class citizens. And I think you can probably guess who the first class are, right at the top there. The second are, of course, the racial strangers, non-whites, Arabs, Asians, and, Africans who come over here. And that's another point worth mentioning is that, a term used in the media here is always to describe Pakistanis and Indians as Asians or Southeast Asians. So especially when they talk about, on the rare occasions they do talk about these rape gangs, they like to use the term Asian because it kind of dilutes it. It's a lot less specific And it does put the idea in people's heads that, oh, these could be, you know, Chinese people. Maybe there's a Chinese rape gang that's been prosecuted for abusing children. But of course, you know, it's a media term. It's not really something that people say over here to refer to Pakistanis, unless they are very well instructed by what they read in the media. But we do have laws specifically in place which privilege non-whites into, for example, job opportunities. And there's the attack on men, which is an attack on white men, because as with all of these things, you know, the anti-male stuff, it can only be enforced against the whites because the non-white males have non-white privilege. So, you know, it's just another aspect of that. Like, the RAF, the Royal Air Force, was looking to hire only non-white males to be like the next generation of fighter pilots, for example. And this is something they push very heavily, but essentially, you know, the indigenous people of these islands, the white people, were third class citizens. We are specifically discriminated against in our own country. We don't have the right to speak our mind or to say things which might offend others. And it's a very subjective definition of what offend is, because of course anything could be offensive to any person. And I am personally offended by the mass rape of children in our country by racial strangers, but that's not something that's going to get a perpetrator of such activity to be arrested. But, you know, over here, you could be arrested for saying words which upset people. And as with many things, which words upset people change over time and they become more and more restrictive. And there's this war on language in which, you know, if you're not using the up-to-date term, that can be an issue in and of itself. And I think you wanted to mention as well.
It's 1984. I always joke that George Orwell, like only an Englishman could come up with 1984, because I've always felt that there's a strain of totalitarianism that runs through the British people, through the English particularly, that it is like, it's like a dark, it's a dark, like it's like an id, it's like a subconscious thing that is just not something that it's sort of like you, through projection, the British ruling class deals with it by projecting it on others. Oh, we're the freedom land, and all the other people are the real totalitarians. And then you have a work of fiction like 1984 that conjures up this like nightmare society. But so many of the concepts in 1984 are things that I just see, not only now, today, but I mean, you know, I study, of course, I've studied a lot of England during World War II, and the way the state operated and the way the state waged the war and then policed its own citizens, it's stuff that is very totalitarian. I mean, it's straight out of the book. It's like, I think that imagination, that streak runs through, I don't know if it runs through the British people or the English people, but it certainly runs through the ruling class.
Well, we have huge amounts of anarcho-tyranny going on over here. As I say, the rape gangs that are ongoing, the black crime in general, which is largely, you know, theft, stabbings, rape. And when they do talk about, you know, knife crime over here, and it is almost entirely a black problem, or, you know, people who have absorbed that culture. So the presence of large black communities does lead to people adopting that, and you do get the the white people who kind of copy that culture, and the non-white immigrants who kind of adopt that, especially that American African culture.
That's what my friend was saying about the Pakis in Britain, is that they're oh, I can't say, can I say that? I Pakistanis, I should say.
I don't think I'm going to get into trouble for you saying that. What I will say is, you know, I, as somebody who lives in Britain and is born of British blood, I am a Brit, which is an abbreviation, and somebody from Scotland would be a Scot.
Right.
Somebody from Pakistan which means land of the Pakis would be a Paki.
Right.
So Stan is a, I think it's a Turkic, suffix originally. It just means land. So
right.
Afghanistan is land of the Afghans and Tajikistan is land of the Tajiks. And by that definition, Pakistan would be land of the Pakis. But I think, Paki is meaning pure. So it's not referring to a people, but the country means land of the pure, which perhaps is, either referring, to genetics or, religious doctrinal purity. I mean, maybe that's why they have such high levels of, inbreeding, because they want to keep pure. And within their own community.
Well, I know that the language,
But yes, you could get into a lot of trouble here for saying, Pakistani, but you could get into trouble for saying a not offensive word with vitriol. You know, if you were to say it in a way which offended somebody.
So that's the anarcho-tyranny, because it's not like I think some of these countries will also, this is because Britain uses common law, which common law versus the continental, like Roman law, as I understand the difference, and I've had lawyers explain the history of this, the common law leaves much more room for interpretation.
If you're hearing this, then you're only getting half the show. Did you know that therightstuff.biz is 100% listener funded? Thanks to this censorship machine, this project can only be sustained by listeners like you, by supporters like you. So why don't you get behind the paywall at therightstuff.biz/paywall? And show the powers that be that they can't silence the most silenced.
Whereas the continental Roman law is based on what is written is what you get, and it's interpreted literally. So you have a law for everything, and it's all specifically enumerated. And anything that's not written specifically in the law, is not covered by the law, or is not, there's not a law against it. So in a continental country, it would be like, you cannot use this word. You cannot use this word. This song is prescribed. This idea is banned, or not this idea, but this book or this flag or this symbol or this salute is banned. But, you know, you could do a different salute that means the same thing. And if it's not written down in the law, you're fine. You're in the clear.
Well, I think it's kind of like, in the past, it may have been a good thing, because when things are a bit more flexible like that, you could say, well, you know, it's not so clear, so we'll err on the side of common sense. And where there is an edge case, you know, we won't prosecute on something like that. But nowadays, it is very much in the other direction. And as much as they try to undermine the First Amendment in the US, I mean, that's something you have directly written into law. There is no guarantee of a free speech in the UK. These rights are constantly under attack. And where free speech does butt up against racial strangers' feelings, or the feelings of anyone in general at any time, the feelings will always take precedent over that. So we have a situation where the Conservative government, which has been in power for over a decade now, I believe, they are masters at creating laws which are deliberately vague to the point that they can be enforced or not enforced in the worst way possible for the inhabitants of the island. And so, for example, you know, one of the results of this latest pro-Palestine demonstration in London and in other places around the UK, but mainly in London, is they want to bring in new laws to criminalise protests. But they will make this new law which then won't be used against Palestine protests, but only against, for example, if PA were to go out and do a protest.
Well, it might be used against Palestine protests if they're threatening the you-know-whos, but it's not going to be used. It won't be used against BLM. Let's put it that way. If they're out there campaigning to tear down statues, I mean, I saw statues in the UK being toppled. There was that one in particular, that was just, I mean, again, this is England. This is insane. The idea of this but it'll never be used on them. This is what I was going to say about the common law. The interesting thing is, a little known fact. One of the things people don't, even our guys, I think, don't realize is that the National Socialist German Workers Party had, in their 25-point program, one of the points is actually calling for an abandonment of the Roman law, which they said is serves a materialistic world order, and the adoption of a common law system for Germany. So they wanted a common law system. Now, to what extent they implemented that in the Third Reich, I'm not entirely sure. I haven't followed up with all of it, but I do know they definitely did get away from, I mean, just anecdotally, I know a few cases where they got away from the thing of like, the law says this, so this is what you must do, as opposed to we're going to give judges more power, more leeway to interpret. But as you said, yes. And of course, we have common law in the United States. I think common law is superior. If it's a high trust, homogenous society, it's like a tribal law. It's like an ancient tribe where you have the tribal elders make a decision. They use discretionary powers to, in their judgment and in their wisdom, make a decision for the good of the whole. In other words, you're not, just following the letter of the law. You're following the spirit of it. That whole idea is so, it's Germanic. It's very ancient Germanic idea. I know that the idea of the Roman law, I think got imposed on Germany during the time of Napoleon, because Napoleon was big on that type of standardized, because it was good for all the areas he was ruling. And it was based in the French Revolution, you know, their style. But yeah, so that idea where you leave a lot of room for interpretation is better in a situation where you have wise rulers and wise men in high office, like judges, who are united with their people, are deeply rooted in their people, and have the best interests of their people at heart. But as you say, if you have hostile people in those roles, if you have those positions of power and influence in the courts occupied by bad guys who are hostile to the main community and the main group, then the common law system becomes, I think, much worse. Because of exactly what you said, anarcho-tyranny. They can interpret the law every time so that the bad guys win, and so it disadvantages the people, and they can do it under color of law, whereas if it was more spelled out, they wouldn't be able to, they would have a harder time doing that.
Well, even, I mean, I talked about this a little bit on the show on Tassel when we were doing that, but we don't have a specific Holocaust denial law in the UK. They do have Holocaust denial laws on the continent in various European countries. So, you know, if in France or Austria or Germany, you say 5,999,999 Jews died in the Holocaust, well, you're denying the one, you're a Holocaust denier, and it is spelled out in that way, more or less. So we don't have that law in the UK, but we do have, you know, nebulous terms on what is offensive and what is grossly offensive, and that can be, and also inciting racial hatred. So I think we're going to come to the point where if they don't introduce a direct law on Holocaust denial, it will be by the back door. It's like, well, it's not illegal to deny the Holocaust or to, you know, doubt things about it, except that by doing so, you know, like, you don't really believe it, and therefore you're just trying to incite hatred against or offend Jews, and therefore that's the crime. And so Holocaust denial, you know, de facto illegal by the back door.
Right. Yeah.
And that's definitely something I can see happening, as time goes on.
Well, I even asked Mark when I was, you know, when we had a discussion about my, what I could put in my speech, and then I was going to do the show with him, and what we could and couldn't say. And it was so interesting the way Mark said it. You know, like, I was surprised in a way at what you can say in the UK. I actually had it in my head that it was worse than what it is when he described it to me. But then, yeah, you get into these gray areas, and then it's really, it's really pretty scary, because at least when the law is harsh, but it's, and it's draconian, but it's clear, you know what not to do and what not to say. And that, and you know, that's the classic thing of, I mean, I'll just say, like, the classic thing of, you know, psychological, torture or abuse or, a situation where you take a person and you give them lifelong, like, PTSD is when someone is put in a position, they're put in a situation where they don't know what the rules are and they don't know when they're going to get punished and when they're going to get rewarded. That puts people into a state of low level anxiety that reduces people down. I mean, again, just to get back to 1984, I don't like to draw on 1984 too much. I don't think I've ever even sat and read the whole book cover to cover. I've read portions of it and sections of it, and I've seen the film, but the concepts are very useful when discussing politics. I'm not even a fan of Orwell. I don't like George Orwell for many reasons, but the whole idea of the 2 + 2 = 4 and what the correct answer is, you know, the O'Brien is, zapping, what's his name? The main character and, Winston, and, you know, how many fingers am I holding up? 4 or 5. That's what it is. How many fingers am I holding up? I know this from the film with John Hurt, less than from the
it's,
book.
It's in Star Trek where he's saying how many, there's 4 lights. How many lights?
Yeah, the 4 lights, right. The Cardassians. We can, that's good. We can, before the first hour is up, we'll make 1 Star Trek reference. We'll concede 1 Star Trek reference. Don't worry. There'll be much more in the next hour. But what I was going to say was,
don't tell them that, Warren, or nobody's going to tune in.
What I was going to say was, though, that the idea is, you know, he says 4, zap, you know, 5, zap, 3, zap, 4. I don't know. And he's like, okay, now that's the correct answer. You know, that's you're better. That's a better answer. Essentially, you don't know until Big Brother tells you. You don't know what the answer is until. So what that creates is it's stripping away all sense of that you have control over your own situation. You can choose to say the right thing that will get you the reward, or you can choose to say the wrong thing that will get you the punishment. That still operating in a system like that, psychologically, you still have a measure of security because you know, here are the bounds. And if I step outside those bounds, I'm going to get hurt. But if I stay in them I comply, I'll be fine. But if you really, you know, a system that's wants to really try to get people compliant and broken, like a broken people, is going to be more a system where it's fairly arbitrary. It's fairly arbitrary. You don't know. And you know, that's again, that aspect of 1984 and of Animal Farm was taken from Stalin and Stalin's, the idea that, you know, you could be like the loyal Stalin guy one day and you still get dragged off into the night, you know, like.
Well, I think you're quite aware. I mean, within the last couple of years, PI has gone from strength to strength. And, you know, there were MPs, members of parliament over here and organizations who were trying to push to change the law because they said PI is being very careful and they're not actually breaking the law, but they're saying things we don't like. So we need to change the law in order to make what they're saying illegal.
Yes. Yeah.
So, exactly. You know, even in the case where, you know, you are careful and the law is so nebulous and they still can't come after you because you're not breaking any laws, they will just change the law to try and make it illegal.
Right. And the whole idea of that is to make you feel powerless. It's to make you feel that there's no chance, that there's no hope, and to demoralize you, because that's what that kind of thing does. In addition to with POW camps where there's that sort of arbitrary brutality, arbitrary punishments and everything, it breaks down the will, and it makes people not only gives them a low level anxiety where they feel powerless, but it also they resign themselves to their fate after a while because it's the only way you can cope with.
Strict punishment is less psychologically devastating on a longer term than, you know, not knowing when it's going to come. It's the metaphorical, it's the sword of Damocles above your head.
Right. Exactly. And yeah, that's no, the British system is horrible. We're going to talk about, a number of things, actually, in the second part. We're going to talk about James Costello, the thing that just happened, the wonderful man who I just had the pleasure to meet when I was over there, who is now facing prison time. I want to talk about UK gun laws because the details are will shock my American friends when you hear the details of how it operates. You and I had a great conversation about that, and I want to go over it. We will get into the different regions of England. So you guys, when you listen to this, you're going to, it's fascinating, and you're going to learn a lot more about England than you ever knew before. And what else? And, we'll eventually probably get to some Star Trek because I found there were some more Star Trek fans over there. My Welsh friend who I met, who's a fantastic guy. Is turns out to be like a bigger DS9 fan than myself. So, and you
would,
as well.
It would happen to be Deep Space Nine. I mean, I seem to remember I had talked to somebody about this outside the venue, and then I came in and overheard you, and I thought, oh, were you continuing the conversation from earlier? And just purely by coincidence, you're on the same thing. But you know, Deep Space Nine is by and large the best. The best series of Star Trek for a number of reasons, but it's also the series with the race of genocidal supremacist alien shapeshifters who want to take over every government they can.
We'll save the Star Trek for the very end. So like you say, this way we won't have anyone who would otherwise subscribe to therightstuff.biz in order to hear all the rest of the conversation. But if they have to sit through some Star Trek, they won't do it.
Did you know that therightstuff.biz is 100% listener funded? The only reason you're hearing this right now is because you're only getting half the show. There's so much content you're missing, and you'll never hear these ads again if you get behind the paywall at therightstuff.biz/paywall.
Or we might have some people unsubscribe because they've heard it one too many times, but there are the dedicated people who will listen right through. So we'll save that for the end. But no, seriously, we're going to be back, guys, here in a minute. If you're not subscribed, rightstuff.biz, please subscribe, or you can join the National Justice Party as a supporter. A dollar a day is the white level supportership, the basic level. And, then you'd be helping the NJP to grow, and you also will get a TRS subscription through that, so access to all our radio content. So if you're not behind the paywall, get behind the paywall, and you can hear the rest of our conversation. We're going to get deep into the English history and many other things. So we'll be back here with Euro, former TASOB, Absolute State of Britain host. Great to have you on the show, brother. We'll see you guys on the other side.
We Hail, Tom!